Chapter 18. On the Couch. It was late at night on May 1st, 2011, when I noticed the news alert on my phone. Osama bin Laden had been tracked down to Abbottabad, Pakistan, and killed by a team of Navy SEALs. So there it was. The man who'd masterminded the attacks that had propelled me into the army, and from there into the intelligence community, was now dead. A dialysis patient shot point blank in the embrace of his multiple wives in their lavish compound just down the road from Pakistan's major military academy. Site after site showed maps indicating where the hell Abbottabad was, alternating with street scenes from cities throughout America, where people were fist pumping, chest bumping, yelling, getting wasted. Even New York was celebrating, which almost never happens. I turned off the phone. I just didn't have it in me to join in. Don't get me wrong. I was glad the motherfucker was dead. I was just having a pensive moment and felt a circle closing. 10 years. That's how long it had been since those two planes flew into the Twin Towers. And what did we have to show for it? What had the last decade actually accomplished? I sat on the couch inherited from my mother's condo and gazed through the window into the street beyond as a neighbor honked the horn of his parked car. I couldn't shake the idea that I'd wasted the last decade of my life. The previous 10 years had been a cavalcade of American-made tragedy. The forever war in Afghanistan, catastrophic regime change in Iraq, indefinite detentions at Guantanamo Bay, extraordinary renditions, torture, targeted killings of civilians, even of American civilians via drone strikes. Domestically, there was the homeland securitization of everything, which assigned a threat rating to every waking day. Red, severe. Orange, high. Yellow, elevated. And, from the Patriot Act on, the steady erosion of civil liberties, the very liberties we were allegedly fighting to protect. The cumulative damage, the malfeasance in aggregate, was staggering to contemplate and felt entirely irreversible. And yet we were still honking our horns and flashing our lights in jubilation. The biggest terrorist attack on American soil happened concurrently with the development of digital technology, which made much of the earth American soil, whether we liked it or not. Terrorism, of course, was the stated reason why most of my country's surveillance programs were implemented, at a time of great fear and opportunism. But it turned out that fear was the true terrorism, perpetuated by a political system that was increasingly willing to use practically any justification to authorize the use of force. American politicians weren't as afraid of terror as they were of seeming weak, or of being disloyal to their party, or of being disloyal to their campaign donors, who had ample appetites for government contracts and petroleum products from the Middle East. The politics of terror became more powerful than the terror itself, resulting in counter-terror, the panicked actions of a country unmatched in capability, unrestrained by policy, and blatantly unconcerned about upholding the rule of law. After 9/11, the IC's orders had been never again. A mission that could never be accomplished. A decade later, it had become clear, to me at least, that the repeated evocations of terror by the political class were not a response to any specific threat or concern, but a cynical attempt to turn terror into a permanent danger that required permanent vigilance enforced by unquestionable authority. After a decade of mass surveillance, the technology had proved itself to be a potent weapon less against terror and more against liberty itself. By continuing these programs, by continuing these lies, America was protecting little, winning nothing, and losing much, until there would be few distinctions left between those post-9/11 polarities of us and them. The latter half of 2011 passed in a succession of seizures and in countless doctors' offices and hospitals. I was imaged, tested, and prescribed medications that stabilized my body but clouded my mind, turning me depressed, lethargic, and unable to focus. I wasn't sure how I was going to live with what Lindsay was now calling my condition, without losing my job. Being the top technologist for Dell's CIA account meant I had tremendous flexibility. My office was my phone, and I could work from home. But meetings were an issue. They were always in Virginia, and I lived in Maryland, a state whose law prevented people diagnosed with epilepsy from driving. If I were caught behind the wheel, I could lose my driver's license, and with it, my ability to attend the meetings that were the single non-negotiable requirement of my position. I finally gave in to the inevitable, took a short-term disability leave from Dell, and decamped to my mother's second-hand couch. It was as blue as my mood, but comfortable. For weeks and weeks, it was the center of my existence, the place where I slept and ate and read and slept some more, the place where I just generally wallowed bleakly as time mocked me. I don't remember what books I tried to read, but I do remember never managing much more than a page before closing my eyes and sinking back again into the cushions. I couldn't concentrate on anything except my own weakness, the uncooperative lump that used to be me spread across the upholstery, motionless but for a lone finger atop the screen of the phone that was the only light in the room. I'd scroll through the news, then nap, then scroll again, then nap, while protesters in Tunisia, Libya, Egypt, Yemen, Algeria, Morocco, Iraq, Lebanon, and Syria were being imprisoned and tortured or just shot in the streets by the secret state agents of thuggish regimes, many of which America had helped keep in power. The suffering of that season was immense, spiraling out of the regular news cycle. What I was witnessing was desperation, compared with which my own struggles seemed cheap. They seemed small, morally and ethically small, and privileged. Throughout the Middle East, innocent civilians were living under the constant threat of violence, with work and school suspended, no electricity, no sewage. In many regions, they didn't have access to even the most rudimentary medical care. But if at any moment I doubted that my anxieties about surveillance and privacy were relevant or even appropriate in the face of such immediate danger and privation, I only had to pay a bit more attention to the crowds on the street and the proclamations they were making in Cairo and Sana'a, in Beirut and Damascus, in Ahvaz, Khuzestan, and in every other city of the Arab Spring and Iranian Green Movement. The crowds were calling for an end to oppression, censorship, and precarity. They were declaring that in a truly just society, the people were not answerable to the government was answerable to the people. Although each crowd, in each city, even on each day, seemed to have its own specific motivation and its own specific goals, they all had one thing in common: a rejection of authoritarianism, a recommitment to the humanitarian principle that an individual's rights are inborn and inalienable. In an authoritarian state, rights derive from the state and are granted to the people. In a free state, rights derive from the people and are granted to the state. In the former, people are subjects who are only allowed to own property, pursue an education, work, pray, and speak because their government permits them to. In the latter, people are citizens who agree to be governed in a covenant of consent that must be periodically renewed and is constitutionally revocable. It's this clash between the authoritarian and the liberal democratic that I believe to be the major ideological conflict of my time. Not some concocted, prejudiced notion of an East-West divide or of a resurrected crusade against Christendom or Islam. Authoritarian states are typically not governments of laws, but governments of leaders who demand loyalty from their subjects and are hostile to dissent. Liberal democratic states, by contrast, make no or few such demands, but depend almost solely on each citizen voluntarily assuming the responsibility of protecting the freedoms of everyone else around them, regardless of their race, ethnicity, creed, ability, sexuality, or gender. Any collective guarantee, predicated not on blood but on assent, will wind up favoring egalitarianism. And though democracy has often fallen far short of its ideal, I still believe it to be the one form of governance that most fully enables people of different backgrounds to live together, equal before the law. This equality consists not only of rights, but also of freedoms. In fact, many of the rights most cherished by citizens of democracies aren't even provided for in law except by implication. They exist in that open-ended, empty space created through the restriction of government power. For example, Americans only have a right to free speech because the government is forbidden from making any law restricting that freedom, and a right to a free press because the government is forbidden from making any law to abridge it. They only have a right to worship freely because the government is forbidden from making any law respecting an establishment of religion, and a right to peaceably assemble and protest because the government is forbidden from making any law that says they can't. In a contemporary life, we have a single concept that encompasses all this negative or potential space that's off limits to the government. That concept is privacy. It's an empty zone that lies beyond the reach of the state, a void into which the law is only permitted to venture with a warrant, and not a warrant for everybody, such as the one the U.S. government has arrogated to itself in pursuit of mass surveillance, but a warrant for a specific person or purpose supported by a specific probable cause. The word privacy itself is somewhat empty, because it is essentially indefinable or over-definable. Each of us has our own idea of what it is. Privacy means something to everyone. There is no one to whom it means nothing. It's because of this lack of common definition that citizens of pluralistic, technologically sophisticated democracies feel that they have to justify their desire for privacy and frame it as a right. But citizens of democracies don't have to justify that desire. The state, instead, must justify its violation. To refuse to claim your privacy is actually to cede it, either to a state trespassing its constitutional restraints or to a private business. There is simply no way to ignore privacy. Because a citizenry's freedoms are interdependent, to surrender your own privacy is really to surrender everyone's. You might choose to give it up out of convenience or under the popular pretext that privacy is only required by those who have something to hide. But saying that you don't need or want privacy because you have nothing to hide is to assume that no one should have or could have to hide anything, including their immigration status, unemployment history, financial history, and health records. You're assuming that no one, including yourself, might object to revealing to anyone information about their religious beliefs, political affiliations, and sexual activities, as casually as some choose to reveal their movie and music tastes and reading preferences. Ultimately, saying that you don't care about privacy because you have nothing to hide is no different from saying you don't care about freedom of speech because you have nothing to say, or that you don't care about freedom of the press because you don't like to read, or that you don't care about freedom of religion because you don't believe in God, or that you don't care about the freedom to peaceably assemble because you're a lazy, antisocial agoraphobe. Just because this or that freedom might not have meaning to you today doesn't mean that it doesn't or won't have meaning tomorrow to you or to your neighbor or to the crowds of principled dissidents I was following on my phone who were protesting halfway across the planet, hoping to gain just a fraction of the freedoms that my country was busily dismantling. I wanted to help, but I didn't know how. I'd had enough of feeling helpless, of being just an asshole in flannel lying around on a shabby couch eating Cool Ranch Doritos and drinking Diet Coke while the world went up in flames. The young people of the Middle East were agitating for higher wages, lower prices, and better pensions. But I couldn't give them any of that. And no one could give them a better shot at self-governance than the one they were taking themselves. They were, however, also agitating for a freer internet. They were decrying Iran's Ayatollah Khamenei, who had been increasingly censoring and blocking threatening web content, tracking and hacking traffic to offending platforms and servers, and shutting down certain foreign ISPs entirely. They were protesting Egypt's president, Hosni Mubarak, who'd cut off internet access for his whole country, which had merely succeeded in making every young person in the country even more furious and bored, luring them out into the streets. Ever since I'd been introduced to the Tor project in Geneva, I'd used its browser and run my own Tor server, wanting to do my professional work from home and my personal web browsing unmonitored. Now, I shook off my despair, propelled myself off the couch, and staggered over to my home office to set up a bridge relay that would bypass the Iranian internet blockades. I then distributed its encrypted configuration identity to the Tor core developers. That was the least I could do. If there was just the slightest chance that even one young kid from Iran who hadn't been able to get online could now bypass the imposed filters and restrictions and connect to me, connect through me, protected by the Tor system and my server's anonymity, then it was certainly worth my minimal effort. I imagined this person reading their email, or checking their social media accounts to make sure that their friends and family had not been arrested. I had no way of knowing whether this was what they did, or whether anyone at all linked to my server from Iran. And that was the point. The aid I offered was private. The guy who started the Arab Spring was almost exactly my age. He was a produce peddler in Tunisia, selling fruits and vegetables out of a cart. In protest against repeated harassment and extortion by the authorities, he stood in the square and set fire to his life, dying a martyr. If burning himself to death was the last free act he could manage in defiance of an illegitimate regime, I could certainly get up off the couch and press a few buttons.